Hey, it's really good to be here with you and to continue the conversation about some of the health challenges for young men and boys of color. I should have had a slide. I don't have one that said I have no conflicts to disclose, so that is in fact correct. And I will transition by giving a little more description, just a little, Alan, and then talk about emergent evidence that is really pointing us to areas in which interventions are possible and there's promise in interventions. So these data are just a little dated, but it illustrates the challenge of, and gives you some descriptive sense of where things are in recent years, looking at child and teen deaths by race and ethnicity in the United States. And if you see the, here is the rate for whites, and you can see the markedly elevated risk that is evident for blacks or African Americans. I'll use those terms interchangeably in my presentation, as well as for American Indians, Alaska Natives, or Native Americans. And you see it in the ages 1 through 4, you see those two groups also are markedly higher, ages 15 to 19. You also see the Latino population also having a pattern of elevated risk. If we look at some of the specific causes that are really very important in those younger ages, you see homicide and the towering excess risk for African Americans with Latinos, Native Americans, and Asians also having higher rates of homicide than the white population does. Motor vehicle accidents is also a major cause of death at younger ages. These are looking at ages 10 through 29, and here you see the markedly elevated risk for Native Americans. Again, and then suicide is another important cause of death at those ages, and Native Americans also have a very elevated pattern. We're talking about boys and men of color, young men and boys of color, and I wanted to illustrate the fact that across all of the racial ethnic categories, you see a pattern of markedly elevated death rates for men compared men and young men compared to girls and women at those ages. Looking at motor vehicles, deaths, homicide, suicide, you can see for all groups the rates are much, much higher for men compared to women, showing that while we have a problem of equity in health in general, the pattern is much more severe, much more pronounced when we look at a pattern among men. And if we look at specific age groups, this is age-specific male-female mortality, so this is now looking at all causes. Again, you see in the 15 to 19 and the 20 to 24 group, you see the pattern really emerges very dramatically, where, again, males of all racial ethnic categories have in 15 to 19, ratios that are twice as high as that of females, and among African Americans and Latinos it's more than three times as high, and you see that pattern continuing. So making the case that really looking at the challenges for this group becomes very important. There are multiple factors that contribute to these: violence and unintentional injuries, substance abuse, physical activity and dietary behaviors, reproductive health, and sexually transmitted infections, including HIV/AIDS. Are major contributors to the patterns for these groups. So I wanted to spend most of my time thinking about what we can do about the problem. And I begin by emphasizing that long-term successful strategies will require us to start early. I just came from a session on the screening of the Raisin of America, a new series that has just been released, will be on PBS during this month by the California Newsreel, the same group that did On Natural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? the same group that did the series Race, the Power of an Illusion, two very powerful series. And this one is equally powerful. And I think this is a commercial, but no personal benefit to me. But I think it really makes the case of the challenges we face in early childhood development as a nation, and the opportunities we have to make a difference in this area. But briefly, the scientific evidence is quite clear that the early experiences in life have pronounced long-term negative effects, not only on immediate functioning, but on health in adulthood. And that while on the one hand, the body has an amazing capacity to adapt to these stressful experiences, when these stressful experiences become excessive and chronic, the prolonged activation of the stress response systems has negative effects that are evident even in early childhood. We can see it in alterations in brain architecture and the secretion of stress hormones, that individual is not only having a challenge responding to the current stressors, but they are left with an impaired ability to respond to future stress. Researchers are using the term toxic stress to describe the strong, prolonged activation of the body's stress management systems in the absence of buffering and protective resources. Examples of toxic stress includes living in chronic poverty, having experienced physical, emotional, sexual abuse, experiencing chronic neglect, being taken care of by a caretaker who is chronically depressed, exposure to substance abuse, of family violence. All of these are examples of it. I and colleagues have a paper forthcoming in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that takes a national look at data on early childhood adversity that documents the dramatic racial ethnic differences, dramatic differences by socioeconomic status, and surprisingly marked differences by immigrant status as well, with immigrants of all racial groups, ethnic groups, doing better than their native-born counterparts on most of the indicators of early childhood adversity. But the point is, these exposure to these toxic stressors have long-term negative effects. And I just wanted to give you a couple quick examples from published research. The ACE score is Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and looking at the number of such experiences individuals have, and higher levels of adversity predicts early higher risk of initiating smoking early, predicts higher risk of being a current smoker, predicts higher risk of having COPD. It matters for virtually every risk factor you can think of in adolescence and early adulthood is shaped by early childhood exposures, but it also predicts chronic diseases in adulthood. And I picked just the example of heart disease to show that someone who has 7 or 8 adverse childhood experiences has a 3 times higher risk as an adult of having heart disease. So it's a really, what this research clearly is telling us is that the foundations of health in adulthood are laid in childhood. And to, in fact, effectively address these challenges, we need to think of what we can do within the early childhood context to make a difference. We now have an emerging body of scientific evidence pointing us to solutions that can be implemented early in life, both within the healthcare system as well as outside of the healthcare system, that can have positive effects. One example of that is evidence from randomized controlled trials as part of the Nurse Family Partnership Project, which had a nurse visit high-risk pregnant women. And there's been an RCT in upstate New York with predominantly white women, one in Memphis, Tennessee with predominantly African-American women, and one in Colorado with predominantly Latinas. And all of them show the same thing, that having these nurse visits that occur during pregnancy and continue during the early years of life have had fairly dramatic effects on outcomes. Improved prenatal behaviors, better pregnancy outcomes, higher rates of maternal employment, improve relationship for the mother with her partner, reduce child abuse and neglect, reduce use of the social welfare system, better spacing of subsequent pregnancies for kids, reduce injuries, juvenile crime, and substance abuse, and it actually saves society money for every $18,000 return to society for every family served. So it's an example of a project where we have high quality scientific evidence that even the cost of using an expensive nurse, you might think, still has savings to society. Another example would be the Perry Preschool Project. Again, has gotten a lot of attention because it's again used a randomized design. Kids in a poor, predominantly African-American housing project in Ypsilanti, Michigan, were randomized to receive this early childhood preschool intervention. At age 40, they have higher levels of education, higher levels of income, employment, savings, home ownership, higher rates of marriage, lower rates of crime, less dependence on social welfare system. And for every dollar invested, there's a $17 return to society. Again, amazing results that an early childhood intervention, preschool intervention, has these long-lasting positive effects. It was not a study designed to look at the health impact, so there wasn't a good assessment of and follow-up of health outcomes, but the best evidence we know, if you intervene in all these fundamental social determinants of health, there should be important consequences. More recently, we have data from the Abecedarian Project, a paper in Science published last year. The Abecedarian Project began even earlier than Perry Preschool Project, took these infants, most of them African-American, all of them poor, from birth. They were placed into this early childhood program in which they got safe in a nurturing environment, good nutrition, pediatric care. In their mid-30s, their lower levels of multiple risk factors of cardiovascular disease and metabolic disease, with the results being much stronger for males. Giving you just one example in the interest of time, in the intervention group, systolic blood pressure is 126 compared to 143 in the control group. So fairly large difference in blood pressure linked to what that child experienced birth through five. That's when the intervention is. Long-term effects. There's relationships between what happens birth to five with being obese and the BMI level in general in their mid-30s. Family structure is an issue that really has to be addressed. It's a sensitive one, but the scientific evidence is quite clear that being raised on average by a single adult has a broad range of negative effects on socioeconomic outcomes that ultimately have negative effects on health. Here is data, for example, of the percent of child in poverty in married couple families and in single mother families and across all racial ethnic groups. You see this powerful relationship of risk, dramatically increased risk of poverty being in a single parent household. I'm going to move on in the interest of time. As we think of family structure, we need to think of what are the determinants of family structure. The scientific evidence here is also clear that economic marginalization of males leads to high rates of male unemployment and low wage rates for males is a central determinant of rates of female-headed households. Marriage rates in the United States are positively related to average male earnings. And marriage rates in the U.S. are inversely related to male unemployment. So this may not be politically correct, but the data suggests that you can predict what happens with marriage if you just look at the economic outcomes for males. And this is true for blacks and whites in studies that have been done in the United States. And these same conditions predict a broad range of negative outcomes. Rob Sampson has done important work on trying to understand the social determinants of violent crime and homicide in the United States. And he has traced the pathways by which these are produced. Lack of access to jobs produces high male unemployment and underemployment. This in turn leads to high rates of out-of-wedlock births, female-headed households, and the extreme concentration of poverty. Single-parent households, there is lower levels of social control and guardianship. That's another way of saying lower levels of supervision of adolescent males in single-parent households. The association between these factors I've just described and violent crime is identical for blacks and whites. Why is violent crime and homicide much higher for African Americans? Because African Americans are more likely to be exposed to these conditions that produce these high rates of crime. Sampson concludes that racial differences at a neighborhood level in availability of jobs, family structure, opportunities for marriage, and concentrated poverty underlie the racial differences in crime and homicide. And in an overview paper, he and William Julius Wilson argues that the sources of violent crime are not linked to family values, not linked to culture, but they are rooted in the structural differences among communities in economic and family organization. And in the 171 largest cities in the United States, there's not even one city where whites live under similar conditions to blacks, and that the worst urban context in which whites reside is considerably better than the average context of black communities. And all of that is a successful result of the implementation of social policy, residential segregation by race, that has produced these social ills that have pervasive negative effects. There is evidence that social policy can cushion some of the negative effects of family structure on poverty and child outcomes, and that these negative effects that we observe in the United States are not inevitable. So here, this is data from UNICEF. Look at the rates of single-parent children in single-parent households in the United States and in Sweden. And Sweden has a slightly higher rate of children in single-parent households than the U.S. But in the U.S., children in single-parent households are very likely to be in poverty. The child poverty rate is very high. In Sweden, the child poverty rate is not high for persons in single-parent households. Here is more data from UNICEF. Basically, before taxes and transfers, the economic system in Sweden produces high child poverty rates before taxes and transfers, just slightly lower than that in the United States. But after taxes and transfers, which is social policy, which is choices a society makes, you have a dramatic reduction in the child poverty rate in Sweden and not much of a reduction in the United States. So it reflects the choices a society makes. I'm not a huge fan of the military-industrial complex, but there is an important lesson we can learn for the military. If you look at military enlistment, it answers an important question for us, as Jay Teachman has been doing work in this area for some time. What would happen if we gave African-American males good, secure employment with good chances of mobility and good benefits? His research shows that active duty military service leads to higher rates of marriage over cohabitation among males, increased likelihood of first marriage, and the greater stability of marriage, and all of those effects are stronger among black men than among white males. So that giving black men good economic opportunity, in fact, changes these outcomes that we often see as very heavily driven. One of the take-home points about the violence problem is that we also have to look at potential solutions at a neighborhood level, and I would say Operation Ceasefire is an example of one of them that has had impact. And the other one I want to talk about is purpose-built communities. It's an initiative in Atlanta, was the first purpose-built community, the East Lake District of Atlanta. They took one of the worst neighborhood areas in that city and made a decision. Again, it takes leadership and it takes decision-making, that instead of dealing with all of the social problems on a piecemeal basis, community activists with philanthropists and the community leadership residents came together and said, we will tackle them at once, developing integrative strategies of cradle-to-college educational opportunity, mixed-income housing, early childhood development, recreational opportunities, economic development for jobs. The results have been phenomenal. There's been a 95% reduction in crime in East Lake since 1995. The employment of low-income persons rose from 13% to 70%. The East Lake District went to the worst performing school in the Atlantic School District, with only 5% of students performing at grade level, to 96% performing at grade level. And there are similar initiatives by the Purpose Built Community Initiative in other cities in the United States. Partly what I'm illustrating is we actually know what to do and we know what works. We have models that are working on the ground. I want to mention two other points in my time that is virtually up. What can we do if we miss that early childhood window? One option is that we can build relationships, and I want to talk about two programs that are making a huge difference. One is the Experience Corps program. The Experience Corps program takes retired individuals, and they make a commitment of a minimum of 10 hours of a week to volunteer in an elementary school. They receive a small stipend. They have to make a commitment to do it. There have been enormous benefits documented for children and the classroom, and improve academics and improve classroom behavior. And then, amazingly, there have been marked benefits documented for these adults who are volunteering. The health of those adults dramatically improves, including fMRI studies that show increase in brain activity among these retired seniors for volunteering. The final example I want to give is one that is addressing an important problem. We don't have good empirical evidence of its work, but it's the U.S. Dream Academy. It's an initiative that is focusing on the children of prisoners and other children in poor, disadvantaged communities who are falling behind in school. Why? Some experts predict that 2/3 of the crime in the future in the United States will be committed by the children of current prisoners. So breaking the cycle and providing those young people with mentoring, with support, with a foundation for academic success is an important strategy for the future. Let me leave you with this thought. Robert F. Kennedy said, "Each time a man or woman stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And those ripples can build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. The health of young men and boys of color faces mighty walls of oppression and resistance, but each of us can be a ripple of hope to make a difference for them." Thank you.